There you go. That's Bob Dylan, who's been nominated for, pardon me, been named, but refused to pick up his prize so far. We're waiting for further developments. We are joined now, I believe, by Mr. Steve Gowans. Are you there, Stephen? Hello?
Hello.
Ah, there he is. Well, Stephen, it's been a while since we've spoken to you. What have you been doing, writing a book?
I have.
I suspected as much. Before we get into matters, what's the book about?
The book is titled "The Long War" or "Washington's Long War on Syria."
Well, that's about as good an intro as we could get to what we want to talk to you about today. You've written two excellent items, in my opinion, and one of them is titled "Our Sieges and Theirs," and the other, "The Revolutionary Distemper in Syria That Wasn't." Because I guess it's today's headlines, we'll start, if you like, with the matter to do with the sieges. I guess we could call it the Tale of Two Cities. It's the U.S. and its allies. I can't be sure who they all are, but at any rate, U.S. and its allies are making a move on the city of Mosul, and they call it the liberation, and that some people discomforted and displaced, but that's what happens when you liberate people from terrible terrorists. And then down the road, there is a fight going on in Aleppo with people with the same profile of terrorists, and Russia and Syria are leading that campaign against those terrorists. And a very important government, Saudi Arabia, which is ahead of now of the United Nations Human Rights Commission, says that at the UN that maybe that the Russia should be investigated for war crimes, for what it's doing in Aleppo, which somewhat resembles what's going on in Mosul. Can you help us out with this? What's going on with this phenomenon? There seems to be a double standard.
There is a double standard, and there are a number of, some journalists who have been pointing this out, but maybe other journalists who are participating in promoting the double standard and this kind of deception, which says that the Syrians and Russians are engaged in some kind of iniquitous behavior in Aleppo, whereas the Americans and their allies and the Iraqis are engaged in a heroic effort to liberate cities. So they're liberating Mosul, and they've liberated Ramadi and Fallujah and Tikrit and all kinds of other places. And the way in which they do that is exactly the way in which the Syrian army and the Russian military, the Russian Air Force in particular, is trying to liberate East Aleppo. And essentially what they do is they, whether it's the Americans or the Russians, the Iraqis or the Syrians, is they bombard the city. They bombard it through airstrikes, through artillery. And then they send in troops as a mopping up force. So this has happened. I mean, the Americans do that. They're doing it in Mosul. They've been bombarding Mosul for months. Mm-hmm. But no one talks about that. And it's not as if there's no one living in Mosul. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of civilians living there. And they're under a siege. They're under bombardment. Mm-hmm. And the United States recovered, or the United States and the Iraqi army recovered Ramadi and Fallujah. When they did that, they essentially flattened those cities, and they caused great humanitarian crises, which were acknowledged. If you'd actually read the press reports at the time, they were kind of acknowledged, but no one carried out this kind of moralistic campaign that's being carried out against the Syrians and the Russians in East Aleppo.
Mm-hmm. There's two headlines today's New York Times, and they certainly match your show why people need to read the article at gowans.wordpress.com, "Our Sieges and Theirs." One New York Times headline today And incidentally, above the headlines, they put recommended reading for their leaders. It's very important we read these articles. One of them is titled, "Wary of Russian Guarantees Residents Stay Put in War-Torn Aleppo." And then the second headline that we have to read, it says, "Aleppo is a slaughterhouse, says UN official seeking war crimes inquiry." but it's time to talk about who are these people who make all these determinations. My understanding is that the gentleman who said that about the slaughterhouse is a Jordanian who represents covers the topic of human rights. His government is involved with Saudi Arabia in bombing Yemen at the moment. And he's talking about East Aleppo being a slaughterhouse. He has no comment, apparently, on Mosul. Isn't it kind of a dangerous thing? I mean, it seems to me they are so blatant at this point. It's as though there is a kind of hysteria in their camp, that they're just going with whatever they think they can get away with. And whether they're exposed or seen to be hypocrites, they don't mind. They just go ahead and say these things.
They do. I mean, and I think part of the campaign, too, part of the way to create this double standard, or the appearance that there isn't a double standard, is to talk about who it is the cities are being liberated from. So the Americans and the Iraqis are liberating cities from ISIL or Islamic State. But the Russians and the Syrians are liberating cities from the rebels. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this distinction drawn between the rebels and Islamic State without acknowledging that the rebels are Islamist militants, just as Islamic State is. But, of course, this is overlooked or obscured that we're talking about Islamic militants. And, indeed, we're talking really about al-Qaeda. We're talking about what's called Jabhat al-Nusra, which is now Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, which is essentially al-Qaeda. But the Western media doesn't like to acknowledge that this is al-Qaeda. Or if we even say that maybe not all of the militants in East Aleppo are al-Qaeda, they are nevertheless Islamists who are, to quote from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, they are intertwined with al-Qaeda. They're interconnected with them, embedded with them, acting as auxiliaries to them, acting under license to them. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially al-Qaeda and groups that are operating with al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. But this distinction is made with simply call them rebels.
Yes.
And then there's the implication that there's somehow, secular pro-democratic groups that have risen up against the brutality of the Assad regime, as they always put it.
Yes. Yes. And that's a matter I definitely want to get into as well on this, of course, the second article. But I noticed this phenomenon of the ability. By the way, some of these journalists are gifted in that they're like the pigs that find truffles. They can find a guy living on the Turkish border who talks about the terrorist occupied areas as though they're permitted to have a kind of Kropotkin commune where they talk to the terrorists, and they're not with the terrorists, but they come and go, and they we're supposed to believe that. But they do. There's one or two individuals who provide them with these absurd stories. And you give a good example of it, actually. You cite Jonathan Cook. He points out that The Guardian, which is a highly respected paper, and people turn to it, I guess religiously there in Britain, the way people turn to the New York Times or, God help us, the Globe and Mail, but they talk about a wonderful job they're doing to liberate Mosul. And then just the same paper with exactly the same facts goes after Russia as a barbaric country that needs to be investigated.
Exactly.
I find it remarkable. I guess I'm just amazed that they're able to keep this show going because I don't know if you follow this or notice it, but people are pointing out that in The Guardian and some of these other journals, if you go to the comments on the articles, they're very heavily critical and skeptical about the material that in previous years would have been passed off as, well, there was an authoritative article. The readers aren't buying it, actually.
Uh-huh.
But I guess the editor says, you know, damn the torpedoes, we go forward. You end your article, by the way, on the one about the siege with a nice quote where President of Assad, where a journalist said innocents are being killed, and Assad says, yes, they are. But this happened in war, and we don't like to have it happen. And then he comes down to saying, he said, you know, we were under siege, and this has been going on for years, but now that we're defeating them, then he says, they're concerned about Aleppo because the terrorists are in bad shape. The Syrian army is advancing.
Right.
Western countries, mainly the United States and its allies, the U.S. and France, feel they are losing the last cards of terrorism in Syria. And it is a point that, to be underlined, is it not, that actually the U.S. does not want al-Qaeda defeated. They want them to survive.
In Syria, I mean, yeah, because they're using Syria, they're using al-Qaeda as a way to bring down the secular Arab nationalist government. And they're acceptable to the Americans. The al-Qaeda group, that is the Jabhat al-Sham, because their focus is on Syria, and their focus is on bringing down a secular government in Syria. ISIS, on the other hand, isn't as acceptable to Washington because ISIS's ambitions are much broader than bringing down the Syrian government. They want to bring down the Saudi Arabian government and the Iraqi government and all of the puppets and satellites of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly not the case that the United States would like to see al-Qaeda come to power in Syria, and they've made that quite clear. In fact, kind of interesting. You can always wonder why it is that the United States regards Islamic State as its enemy, but wants to talk about al-Nusra as simply the rebels, when both groups are officially designated as terrorist groups by both the United States and the UN Security Council. But the United States acts as if it's only Islamic State that is officially designated as a terrorist organization. And, you know, one can ask, why is that? And why is it that the United States designated al-Nusra as a terrorist organization? And if you dig into it, what you find out is that the United States designated al-Nusra as a terrorist organization to, quote, send a signal to others, their allies in the Middle East, that they would not tolerate al-Nusra coming to power in Syria. Mm-hmm. So they're willing to use them as a cat paw, as a way of driving the secular nationalists out of power, but they certainly don't want to see them in power in Damascus.
Yes. By the way, it permits them to do there what they've done in Afghanistan and Libya, which is permanently interfere.
Yeah.
Because every time there's a neighborhood fight, the ambassador shows up to sort them out, and power of the U.S. itself increases. But that brings us to your article, which many people are reading and commenting on, because there's nothing like a good argument, you know. And Mr. Eric Dracer in Counterpunch thought he would help everyone out by discussing how the struggle in Syria should be perceived. I'm looking for the title of his piece. I found it. It's titled Syria and the Left, Time to Break the Silence. So I couldn't quite make out what his point was, but you did help me by discussing what his premises were, and you're up to your old tricks of course, using facts and logic, which is really not fair in a great polemical battle. Your point is it not that he starts from the wrong? He has some basic assumptions that are not borne out by the evidence. Could you? I'll leave that to you. What is wrong with his argument there?
Well, he and many others have been making this claim that you'll hear this said often. People will say, well, you know, there might be this Islamist insurgency against the Syrian government now, but it started off as a bunch of secular pro-democrats who were revolting against Assad's neoliberal policies. Mm. This is widely believed. Mm-hmm. And what struck me about that is I follow foreign affairs pretty closely, and I couldn't recall at the time reading about any uprising that was related to this quest for democracy or for or against neoliberal or the so-called neoliberal policies of this.
There were no chants down with neoliberalism.
But yes, but I thought, well, maybe I wasn't paying close enough attention, so I think maybe I'll go back and look at this. And what I did was I went back and I reviewed press articles about what was going on in Syria in the weeks immediately prior to the date that is regarded as the beginning of the uprising, and in the weeks immediately following. So I looked at all the mainstream newspapers to see what was happening. And the reports are really interesting because what you see is reporters saying, you know, we've had uprisings going on throughout the Arab world, but nothing seems to be happening here in Syria. And this is really surprising to us. So we're investigating why it is that nothing's happening. And we have Time reporters, the New York Times reporters saying, well, the reason nothing's happening is because everyone seems to support the government. Mm-hmm. Assad seems to be pretty popular. Mm-hmm. And they talk to people and ask them, why is it that there's no uprising here in Syria as there is elsewhere in the Arab world? And people are saying, well, why would we? I mean, one person who was interviewed in particular said, it was a student saying, we get free university, we have free textbooks, we have free all kinds of things. There's really no reason to revolt against the Syrian government. We're happy with it. Mm-hmm. So that struck me as interesting. Then we have this particular date, March 17th, when there was riot in Deraa. And today, people talk about a largely peaceful demonstration or a largely peaceful revolt that was suppressed by the Syrian government. Mm-hmm. Largely, I mean, when someone says largely peaceful, that's interesting.
Yes.
If you read the stories about what's going on March 17th, it was a riot in which about hundreds of people, not thousands or tens of thousands, were burning the governor's office. They burned the Ba'ath Party headquarters. They were burning telephone exchanges, burning cars. Mm-hmm. And there are also reports of gunfights, clashes with police. So clearly, I mean, this was not a peaceful demonstration, not a peaceful uprising. But it's interesting to ask, well, what were they demanding? And you can find out the demands because the demands were reported by the New York Times and Time. What they were demanding, or those who are participating in these riots, were demanding, quote, an end to corruption and an end to the security law. And the security law is just the kind of a War Measures Act. And the War Measures Act was in place because Syria was and still is officially at war with Israel. Mm-hmm. And then if you read the reports, you'll see that the Syrian government immediately responded to those demands.
Oh, by the way, there's an additional one, is there not? The release of prisoners.
Oh, yes, release of political prisoners. But release of political prisoners, who are political prisoners in Syria, were largely members of the Muslim Brotherhood, so a militant organization which had been locked in a death feud with the secular nationalists in Syria since the late 1940s, and have declared that they're in a battle to the death with the Ba'athist government.
Yes.
So most of the people who are political prisoners in Syria are Islamists, violent Islamists, and so there are demands being made to release violent Islamists. Mm-hmm. anyway, so you continue to follow these stories in the New York Times, and Time, you'll discover that pretty quickly they start talking about a series of riots throughout Syria that have an Islamist content. Mm-hmm. And they're riots involving hundreds of people, not tens of thousands. At the same time, you have this massive demonstration in Damascus in support of the government. And the numbers demonstrating there are far in excess of the numbers of people who are really engaged in violence against the government in riots that have this Islamist content. So there seemed to be absolutely no evidence that there was an uprising for democracy. By the way, none of the demands that were ever made were for Assad to step down. There are no demands to change the constitution, although the constitution was changed. The security law was also rescinded. So most of the demands that were made were immediately accommodated. And in fact, the Syrian government went way beyond any of the demands that were made. Well, except that I don't believe they didn't release political prisoners. But
Something very important, I think we should underline in the minutes we have, that you point out that this claim about neoliberalism, which, by the way, is just swallowed holus bolus by everybody, just as everybody swallows holus bolus, it was just, you know, a peaceful demonstration, and then all of the people got mad because of the police repression. But you point out that actually the U.S. has wanted to get rid of this government for a long time, because it is Ba'athist, and also because there is one of the pillars of the Ba'athist government is socialism.
Yeah.
And I know that Mr. Dracier and others are not going to wait to hear that, but that happens to be a fact, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And you can look at the U.S. government documents in which they complain that the Syrian government was not embracing neoliberal policies. And look, they've got all these old-style socialist policies like state-owned enterprises, and they're using this kind of socialist approach to try to overcome the legacy of underdevelopment related to colonialism. So the idea that Syria was it embraced neoliberalism is completely absurd. Also absurd is the idea that the United States tries to overthrow governments that have embraced neoliberalism. They don't try to overthrow them. They protect them. But yeah. I used to hear this in connection with Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe as well. We had people who would claim that Robert Mugabe is pro-imperialist and he's neoliberal, and that's why the U.S. government's trying to overthrow him.
And Tony Blair, the reason he didn't give the money back was that Robert wasn't sufficiently socialist. There is also, you point out, that this ideology is nationalist, and that's another factor they don't like. And it has to do with, I know that this is your thesis in many of your essays, is that any country that says to the United States, we're not going to accept diktat from you, is put on a list, basically, for regime change.
Yeah, because the United States is very clear in its documents, for example, the 2015 National Security Strategy, that the United States, as they put it, can and will lead the world. You can follow us voluntarily. No, we're going to lead the world and establish a dictatorship over the world.
And you can take that to the bank, as they say. Well, Stephen, it's been great to talk to you. I really recommend everybody. This is The Revolutionary Distemper in Syria. There wasn't. I wish we'd devoted an hour to this. Of course, it's gowans.wordpress.com. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
This is Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. Find us on Facebook, / The Taylor Report, and write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. That was me hanging up, and this is me speaking into whatever that noise was. And I really appreciate Charlotte's great work. She has a lot of chores here. And Phil Connor, thank you very much. And we will see you next week.
sur les uns, sur les deux, mon ami.